Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Asciano Quarterly Update conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star, followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today, 10th of November 2011. I would now like to hand the conference over to your first speaker today, Mr. John Mullen. Please go ahead, sir.
Hello, everybody. It's John. I'm here with Angus and Kelly and Rita. I'm very happy to answer any questions that you might have. I suggest we go pretty well straight into Q&A, but just say a couple of words before we start. We've just completed our AGM, obviously, and we've also put out the first quarter high-level stats, which, in summary, we actually are quite pleased with. We think, considering the ongoing headwinds in a few areas, that actually really gone quite well for the quarter. The ports business was materially impacted, of course, by the MUA action, which has been extremely damaging during the period. We also had weather, so the fact that we still had the volume growth that we did was certainly very much the upper end of our own expectations as a result of all of that, and I think bodes well for the periods going forward. If we turn to rail, they've continued to do well in the quarter, despite, again, soft economic conditions on the intermodal side, et cetera. Bulk, as you've seen from the numbers, has been very strong. Coal, the New South Wales figures, of course, have pulled down our overall volumes there because the prior period comparison had the Peabody volumes and the rolling contract for Xstrata in there, X-Rail, which if you take those out, normalise that we're sort of pretty flat year on year in New South Wales. Since we haven't won any other contracts, that's pretty well where we'd have expected to be. Queensland, of course, has had the ongoing sort of weather impacts with the whole industry suffering around a 15% fall, so we've sort of been part of that as well. But that seems to be, again, drawing hopefully to a close, so we're still sticking by our original expectations for growth in the coal division for the year. So all in all, we felt it was a pretty positive quarter, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Your first question comes from the line of Scott Carrolls from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Hi, John. Just a quick question on the EBAs. I was just curious if the productivity improvements that were in those overnight were assumed in the $82 million of savings that you outlined under the strategy review?
Those savings they're not directly linked to that EBA. So when we announced the savings at the strategy review, we'd already assumed that the EBA would go through at a certain level. Now there may be some minor up and down adjustments to the port's numbers around the final outcome of that, but no, I think you can separate the two.
Yeah, so what I would say, though, is the 40-plus million that we, if you like, sort of call the new term around, Patrick, would not have been, well, so not would not, will not be possible without the EBA that we've just put in place.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it was a critical plank for us to get in play in order for us to now actually start leveraging the business for those business improvement opportunities within Patrick specifically.
Okay, thanks very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Cameron McDonald from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Just a question on the sequential improvement at Patrick Ports. Given that it's 8% up over the PCP and 18% for the sequential period, what do you think the underlying growth rate is relative to the market share shift with Maersk?
You mean the underlying industry growth?
Yeah.
It's been really up and down month by month, but currently it's in the sort of 4 to 6% on an annualized basis. But either quarters have swung all over the place, of course, and some of the months have gone up, very significantly. Like September had some very strong growth.
So to give you some hard numbers, maybe, if you look at September quarter versus June quarter, you know, the total port volume is up by about 9.5 percentage points. If you then look at September quarter versus PCP, it's 4.5. So you know, that, if you like, is the overall industry. You know, us within that, if you like, quarter to quarter, so September quarter to the prior to the June quarter, you're seeing a 23% lift on our business, and you know, quarter to prior PCP is about 11. So, you know, MERS plays a large role in there. Productivity is playing a role in there, particularly outside of Sydney. Sydney actually is a drag on those numbers at the moment for that quarter. But you know, the number that we're probably most focused on at the moment is, you know, we're seeing port volumes as an industry year over year at that 4 to 5 percentage point level right now. Critical quarter, obviously, we're in the midst of right now, with obviously pre-Christmas trade either having landed or landing.
Okay. The is there any timing benefits that you're generating in the September quarter? Because previously we've seen timing issues impacting you negatively with the split between customers with you and DP World. Is there any benefit that you're getting in this quarter that we should be aware of?
I'll be honest, I don't quite know what you mean, but I'm not certainly seeing anything in terms of... So us versus DP, I don't see anything, so maybe two quick answers. Just I know where we are, frankly, at a bit of a disadvantage in the prior year is, if you like, point of origin. So last year we had in our business, you know, business that came out of the United States. That is hurting some of them because we obviously have lost some of those customers. So probably the only, it's not timing, it's, I suppose, trade pattern is just where cargo is originating from. But there's nothing that I can think of that is, us versus DP World that's affected the quarter.
Okay.
Really, what I would say, and obviously MUA has affected the quarter and obviously has affected October / early November to the degree to which we've been subcontracting any volume into DP World to cope with the MUA challenges and also the backlog that occurred in Sydney due to some of the weather impacts there.
Yeah, but you shouldn't underestimate the impact of that. The number of vessels that either skipped altogether or went to other ports, direct to Melbourne, and then we did transshipments back, or conversely, as Angus says, went to DP who handled on our behalf. That will certainly muddy the waters for this first quarter.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Anthony Mulder from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Just a couple of quick questions. The volume growth that you were just discussing, that's TEU volume?
Yes, correct.
Okay, not containers. The second question, the 40 million, back to the first question, I think it was, the 40 million that you talked about as far as cost savings with this new EBA, is that net of the increase in costs or increase in salaries that you've offered to the MUA?
No, so make sure I'm clear, Anthony. I was just referring to this. Obviously, Patrick's got, you know, roughly 50% of our overall business improvement commitments that we've put out to the marketplace. My comment was just really that without the EBA being in place, that we wouldn't be able to leverage the business enough to get those EBA benefits. We've only given gross numbers in our release around the cost of the EBA. We actually haven't given the net around productivity. It's clearly there, and I think you can clearly get an indication of the quantum of it. But to land on a hard number is going to be dependent upon us, obviously, and also the MUA delivering on those productivity benefits.
Fair enough. And when do you expect some of those to start coming through?
Well, John, I don't really want to talk about what we're already seeing.
Is it happening even before we've signed the deal? As a sort of gesture of good faith, I think all parties are trying to make this work. And as of this last weekend, some of the long-standing productivity strengths, particularly in Port Botany, seem to be disappearing. And we've just give you some examples of numbers. You know, we're averaging, we've only been averaging sort of 160 to 170 lifts per shift in Port Botany over the last few months during all this dispute. And that's immediately gone over 200. Some of the individual crane gangs with admittedly the right type of ship and timing and things like that have gone into the high 200. So it's a very significant improvement. Fremantle, similarly, there have been constraints there. Those have also lifted, and we're seeing enhanced performance there. Melbourne and Brisbane because it's an automated terminal, Melbourne, it's always just run fairly well, have seen lesser improvements, but as the continuous operations and some of those more structural changes come in, we'll see bigger lifts in productivity there as well.
All right, perfect. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Simon Mitchell from UBS. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Just a couple of questions. First one regarding the MUA agreement. John, could you just go into a bit more detail perhaps on the specific changes that have been agreed up front with the union, and things such as the timing of meal breaks as an example?
Yeah, there's a whole raft. There's about 71 items. I could spend the whole call going through it all with you, but some of the more significant ones are the elimination of productivity caps, which theoretically don't exist, but in reality they do, where union for many, many years in Sydney and in Fremantle have prevented performance going over certain levels, whether in the guise of safety or the guise of whatever. They've prevented that with a view to trying to get more manning and more overtime, etc., to cover, rather than having individual performance achieve the same goal. So those are now gone, and those are probably the biggest single gaps. But then on top of that, you had all sorts of issues like, as we've said, the continuous operations, where for every meal break in all ports, the entire port grinds to a halt, which is sort of akin to stopping a car production line or the baggage handling at Qantas when you come in from your flight. Just everybody stops for an hour and goes and has lunch, and everything just sits there. I mean, that's endemic in the industry. We've had all of that lifted. So that by shifting meal breaks around between half an hour and 45 minutes, that's all it takes. You can then keep those operations going continually. And then we're addressing a whole raft of other minor things, but they all add up to a lot all around the way manning levels are operated, the control of rostering. I mean, in Sydney, the union did its own rostering, and they rostered people on when they felt it was most advantageous from an overtime perspective, or if you get rostered, asked to come in on your rostered day off, and that, then also do a weekend, you end up only having to do two or three days' work a week, and you get paid a full salary. All of those sort of things, as part of this deal now, go, and we take control of rostering again. Now, some of this stuff is going to be extracted over time. The majority is pretty well immediate, but some of it's going to take time. Some of the areas of absenteeism, sick leave, you know, we've got 70 people off only one time for some nefarious reason of a sprained neck or some wretched thing. By working through all of these things, now we're going to start bringing all of those levels down. Our workers' compensation premiums in Sydney are about seven times, I think, Angus, what they are in Melbourne for a comparable port with a comparable level of staff. Again, none of that's really to do with workers' compensation. It's all to do with the industrial relations environment in that port. So we've got still an ongoing task to work through all of those things, but I really think that we've opened the door now. This is a real beachhead to starting to normalise the workplace relations and the waterfront. We're not going to win it by confrontation, a la 1998. Those days are gone, and certainly with the current government in power, so we're going to have to do it by the sort of approach I think we've been taking now, which is to slowly chip away at it and take management control back. And that's really the biggest single obstacle that we've been fighting in getting this agreement. It hasn't been around the money so much. It's been around all of this other stuff, which is management's right to manage. That management should decide the staffing levels that we need. Management should decide whether you contract out first aid or you contract out maintenance or whether it has to be done by MUA at MUA rates. And management should decide who works on what roster. Management decide what gangs work, what ship and when. And all of those things over the decades have been in the control of the union, and we are changing that. A rather long-winded answer, but there's been a lot going on.
Okay, thank you. And just quickly on the coal business, you said volumes were down, or NTKs were down 9%. I think we realise that contracted volumes are probably a better indication of what the business achieved in terms of profitability. So can you give us some idea of what contracted tonnage was for that period in terms of growth?
Well, I think the obvious figure there that illustrates that is the fact that revenue was up 14% during the period. despite the net ton kilometre decline. So I think that shows the result of the take or pay from the contracted volumes, as well as, of course, some of the pricing changes and other improvements over the last year.
Well, maybe another way, are there a number of train sets which went into the business during the September quarter that weren't there in the prior quarter?
I think the answer is no. I don't think we actually... There's no new trains being run. I know that in New South Wales, we recommenced the operation on a couple of train sets that we'd parked up over the back end of last fiscal year. Queensland, clearly, we've continued to increase our rate of turn, but no new trains have been introduced in that market. The next big load of trains that go in, actually, are going in at the moment on, if you like, on test before we kick off both Anglo and Middlemount on January 1.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jonathan Collett from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. I think Cameron sort of already asked this question, but maybe I can just ask it another way. If we strip out the industrial action and the wet weather effects in Port Botany, what would you deem to be probably the underlying growth that you would have achieved in containerless relative to PCP?
We've played with that. It's always really hard to know what if, etc. But it would have been into double digit growth. That's for sure.
I mean, just probably to give you the best indication I can give you, and clearly, obviously, John, we're not answering this particularly directly.
Mm.
But if you think about quarter to quarter again, so this is PCP, Sydney was down over that quarter by half a percentage point as a port. Our growth was up at 3.2, and that reflects the new business that we've put through. But, if you take Melbourne as an example within that, Melbourne was up by 9.5%. So that reflects Melbourne getting a lot of Sydney's volume as we redirected traffic, as frankly others did, particularly for weather reasons, but in our case it's both weather and MUA. So you can just see how poorly Sydney as a port performed over that period of time, but you can see our relative overperformance due to new business.
Yep. Okay, thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Ian Miles from Macquarie Equities. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Look, I guess when you look at it at a broader level, all of the issues over the last sort of 12 months have sort of been addressed in terms of coal contracts, now the MUA dispute. How long before we can actually start to see the management initiatives, and I think as you describe it, the business now being in your control, how long before we can actually see the effects of your management coming through the earnings numbers?
Well, I was sort of rather hoping you were already seeing it, actually.
I don't think the quarterly numbers are quite readable like that, and you didn't give us any guidance to measure it.
Well, look, I think if you... As you just said, if you go back to over the last 9 months or so, if we look at all the milestones and things that had to be done, I think there's quite a long checklist there of success. There were two or three of those big contracts, the Rio repricing and the BMA and all these things that have been hanging out there for quite a while. The MUA thing was something that's also that's been going on for over a year now. So we've won a lot of contracts. We've fixed some of these ongoing underlying issues, like the MUA stuff. We've built, a very robust management team. Now we achieved 21% EBIT increase for the year just gone, and we're still seeing strong growth going into this year, this last quarter. We're looking positive as well. So I think we're tracking pretty well. Patrick's was not in good shape 6 or 9 months ago. We've won back market share, and although this first quarter with the MUA and everything else will be below our original expectations, it's still moving positively, and hopefully going now into the second quarter, we're going to see material improvement with the MUA and all the rest of it behind us. So I think most of the indicators are pretty positive. I mean, it would even be nicer if we hadn't had an MUA ongoing dispute and we had buoyant economic conditions in intermodal and a few other areas, but by and large the company's in as good shape as it's been for a while.
So effectively on a sort of quarterly basis, we should start to be seeing you hit more of the normalised numbers going forward from Q2 and Q3 this year?
Well, I think we're not running off Q1 either. I mean, I think, although the coal volumes were down, we had 14% revenue growth in coal during the first quarter. That's not bad. So I think we'll still have a good first quarter, but we hope that it will accelerate further into the subsequent quarters.
Yeah, Ian, to put it maybe even a harder point on it, I mean, so yeah, volume's down, but based upon the way the business is now contracting, the new pricing relationships that we've got there, you're going to see, what we told you, you're seeing great revenue growth first quarter. We certainly, we'd suggest that certainly continues into quarter two. We've got new volume coming on stream in Q3 with Anglo Middlemount coming in. And obviously you continue to get the uplift on the coal and allied agreement there. Patrick, the market share is clearly there today. Frankly, with the issues we've been dealing with, we're not hitting our straps through to call it, last week, but we are now capable of doing that. We've now got that one to bed. And then, from intermodal perspective, we've got greater bulk volume flowing through the business. The intermodal business, whilst, it's never been spectacular, it's still performing incredibly well, relative to history. So I think you are seeing that. I mean, reality is the numbers that we've put out, in many cases, it's unfortunately other people's volume rather than, if you like, volume impact. What we're showing you, I think, is this business now is on a very stable, growing platform and consistent with what we've been telling you certainly John and I have been telling you for the last 9-12 months.
And I'd just like to underline as well that we're obviously, in the end, we're focused more on bottom line earnings growth than we are on revenue growth.
That's really admirable. But I guess you try and reconcile those statements about predictability, reliability of the business, yet in the sort of broader commentary which your board signed off on, it's actually very vague. The word strong growth is, quite a vague term. And your unwillingness to sort of have the management team measured in some way externally. I'm just trying to understand the reasoning why you as a team willing to sort of put a bit more of colour around the sort of that outlook statement.
Well, I'm a little surprised to hear you say that. At the investor day, we stood up and...
I know, that's the thing which people are sort of grappling with. You gave a wonderful amount of confidence in the future about your predictability, yet on a 12-month horizon, it's quite vague.
You're in this place where, not unlike many companies right now, just with all the economic uncertainty right now, we're not going to give explicit guidance right now.
But we're not resiling in any way from the picture that we painted at Investor Day. And to the opposite of what you've just said, I've read about myself in the newspaper being described as crazy for giving too much detail and being pinned down on measurement targets to be measured by. So I'm a little surprised to hear you say that we're being vague. I mean, I think we're sticking absolutely to the commitments that we put out a few months ago. We think we're still on track for that. I mean, all we're saying is that to sort of give you quarter by quarter or year by year over the next 9 months hard number would seem a little foolish in the current economic climate. I mean, every day we come into work and somebody in Greece has said something and our price has gone up and down by 5% or more. So people go sell, 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 buy, et cetera. And, it's a pretty unstable time, but I think we're still very committed to the trajectory that we enunciated only a couple of months ago.
Okay, that's great. Thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from the line of David Fickling from Dow Jones. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. I mean, just on a sort of related point about what we're seeing going forward, obviously there's some concerns about the fact that we're looking at a bad wet season in eastern Australia. Are you putting any contingency plans in place to deal with that and the possible hit to export coal exports from that?
Well, so far as we and the industry can, I guess we are. I would say nobody is banking on a pattern last year, although statistically there's nothing to stop two once-in-a-hundred-year events happening. But no one's planning on that. But that said, but in particular the Blow Rail, we've worked with QR and they've actually done a hell of a lot of work to shore up the network and prepare for the eventuality that we get more weather sort of akin to what we've seen. We feel very confident that the network is far more robust this time round than it was last year. We also learned a lot of lessons during the wet about positioning of trains and how to come up with creative solutions of routing different ways, etc. Those plans actually proved pretty solid. I think we did better than the industry in that period, and we've refined that still. So I think, assuming it's just a bad wet season, I don't think we will see any demonstrable issues. Obviously, if we had enough wet season that the producers themselves don't produce coal, well, then we're obviously not immune to the impact of that. But I think they also have been working on they're better prepared for that.
Have you, in terms of some of your sort of ratings to get stuff into port stockpiles, are you, has there been more of that going on than in a normal year to just make sure it's down near the ports?
Well, I think at the moment, with the lack of volume that we've seen, particularly in Queensland, all the producers are trying to ramp up production anyway, and particularly to try to do it ahead of the wet season. So I think that's why we're pretty optimistic that the second quarter is going to, this quarter now, is going to see markedly improved volumes again.
Yeah. Just on this relates more to Patrick and is maybe pretty early stages, but you know, obviously we're seeing a lot of headwinds from the global economy, and one of the areas this first shows up in is in things like trade credit a lot of the time. Are you seeing any of issues like that showing up in your customers at this stage?
Well, we're not seeing it in the ports particularly. The ports are rebounding from the sort of real lows of 2008-2009, particularly. You know, through 2010, it was still pretty ordinary, but started to improve. And now the last couple of months, or the last two or three months, have been quite good. This is an importing nation, island nation, all those things. I think it's slightly more insulated. Where we do see it, though, is in the modal volumes, which are sort of flat best. So the rail volumes we're seeing east west south corridors, that's pretty tough.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Matt Spence from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hi guys. Just on the EBA, we understand you can't make forced redundancies in this new EBA.
You understand what? Sorry, I didn't hear.
That you can't make forced redundancies in this EBA.
No, we can. Absolutely. You can. That was one of the core planks of this negotiation. We have to have the right to manage the business and manage the size of the workforce as required.
Okay. And so we've had some details from you on automation, but how quickly can you move on that?
On automation?
Yeah.
Well, automation's been a success in Brisbane, and we obviously now have to look at the timing and application of it elsewhere in the network, but we haven't made any hard decisions on that as yet. We've really been focused, particularly with the EA side of things, on ensuring that we've got a stable workforce before we go to any next round. And obviously that's something we really don't particularly want to talk about too publicly. We've just got the confidence of the workforce back and relations with the union in good stead, as can be. So those sort of plans we will get to when we can.
Okay. And the size of the one-off payment that members get on signing the EBA, we got details on everything else late yesterday, but we didn't get details on the size of that one-off payment.
Yeah, it's not a large amount. It's equivalent to about 2% of salary.
Okay, that's very helpful. And just one last quick one. The split between express and super freighter in the intermodal business is something you've provided in the commentary in the past. Is super freighter actually going backwards? Can you give us some idea there?
Look, it's sort of very, very flat to, you know, down a little bit, up a little bit, whereas express is growing really quite strongly into the sort of low double digits.
Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Julianne Spark from the Financial Review. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi. Look, I just wanted to talk to you about the union negotiations. Now that they're sort of wrapped up, can I get your comments on what you think about the current IR system in Australia?
How long have you got?
As punchy as possible, that's fine.
Look, I don't think that the current IR situation in Australia is ideal. I think that the country is losing a lot of opportunity in increasing productivity, which is talked about but is not being delivered by any of these sort of agreements and current industrial climate. The country is going backwards. I think we're creating a rod for our own back, particularly if you look at some industries generally, but particularly those sort of related to the resources industry, to oil and gas, offshore, all these areas, particularly in the West, where these very large increases are coming through without adequate productivity offsets, and then they're being driven through into other sectors of the economy where they can be far less afforded. And I don't think the climate, the current environment, is really conducive to proper bargaining. We talk about fair and reasonable bargaining, and that's, I don't see that happening in all cases. In our position, I don't want to comment on other companies, it's their own affair, but in our position, I did not see a win from confrontational approach, because although we had to be tough, and I think we have been during these negotiations, a full-out confrontational solution or approach to it would have been very, very counterproductive to the long-term interests of this company and the waterfront.
Okay. So,
but that, the downside of that means that it's taken 12 months where a proper process should have allowed it to have been done in 3 months.
Okay. So do you think Qantas did the wrong thing then by grinding its sleep in that dispute?
I think you'd have to ask Qantas that. I don't think it's for me to comment on them,
okay.
But all I can say is in our case, I think a total shutdown of the national port system would not have been in anybody's interest.
Okay, sure. And sorry, just to clarify, I wasn't sure if it was mentioned earlier in this call, but do you plan to make redundancies in the next year?
Well, we obviously don't talk directly about the sizing of the workforce or whatever, but what I would say is that I think it's absolutely critical that we don't see this EA settlement now as just, well, that's it, tick the box, we've got that for the next 5 years and we'll look at it again at the end of the period. I think this is just the beginning, where we now have to work with the union and with our employees to once and for all try to normalise workplace relations on the waterfront.
Okay,
it's been absolutely terrible for decades, and while 1998 made some improvements from an employer's perspective, it didn't fix a lot of the underlying disassociation of employees, workforce from management, etc. And we're very committed to trying to resolve that now in a productive and non-combative nature, so that we have an ordinary workforce environment. We won't always agree, but we shouldn't have the sort of mayhem that the industry's seen in the past.
Okay, great. And just one final one. And when do you think the coal miners will be back at full capacity, and are you worried about the slowdown in demand from China?
Well, if I start with the latter bit, we're not worried too much about China. I think that China's growth drops off from 11% to 9% or something, and everyone says, oh, my God, where are we going? I think if it goes half that still, there's still going to be robust demand for Australia's resources, so I don't see that as a major threat at all at the moment.
And the coal miners, when do you think they'll be back at full capacity?
Sorry, yes. Well, again, I think you'd really have to ask them, but it's certainly obviously taken them a lot longer than expected. And this last quarter, I think we saw Queensland volume still down 15% year on year. I don't think we expected that, and probably the producers didn't either. They, I think, felt pretty well by the middle of the year, things would have been back to calendar year, things would have been back to normal, and now people are saying the end of the calendar year, which I guess is only a few weeks away now. So we're surely coming out of it. In our particular case, we had a number of mines that were very, customers' mines that were very seriously hit. That's now down to sort of really one or
or so. So we're seeing the improvement, but it's obviously taking the whole industry longer than everybody.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Scott Riel from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks very much. I think this is an extension of Simon's question earlier. I was wondering if you could give us an indication of what coal volumes you've got contracted for this this financial year. I know at the full year result, you talked about an additional 6 million coming online, which was the Northern Missing Link contracts primarily. But are you able to give us an idea of, for the full year, what you've got contracted?
Well, the additional tonnage to come on during this year is the Middle Mount and Anglo contracts, which are both starting in the new year. The Middle Mount and the first half of Anglo starting in January, and the rest starting towards June, so it'll be just at the end of the financial year. The balance of the 169 odd million tonnes committed versus the 122 we have now will be coming on in the following financial year and year after.
So just to labour on it, I guess, what are you able to say what your absolute contracted level of tonnes is for this year?
Let me
tell you what I'm trying to do, John, is figure out, the obviously down 9%, I'm trying to figure out whether there were permanent volume losses in New South Wales and how much they were, and then what the impacts in Queensland were that will be normalised out once the miners are back and also are subject to take or pay protection.
So the short answer is in Queensland and in New South Wales, there are absolutely permanent contracted tonnes that were lost in that sense. Either they won't be delivered just simply because of where the different mines are at. We said in New South Wales our core issue, the three core issues in New South Wales were the loss of Peabody in the prior fiscal and the loss of those train sets for X-Rail. And then the other issue we've got, which we're still currently dealing with in New South Wales, is Port Kembla, where with the loader issues that have gone on there, our customers have been disadvantaged because they can't get coal out of the port, whereas those customers that are actually trucking coal into the port can actually get volume out. Queensland, it's all about wet weather, and that continues all previous week. But the part that you're not going to be able to just reconcile the 9% that we've given you, which is NTK versus contracted tonne.
What are New South Wales down, though?
Oh, we haven't given that split.
No, I know. That's why I'm asking.
We're not going to give that split.
Right, okay.
I think we did say New South Wales is not materially down if you take out those two comparatives of on prior period. We're not seeing a major decline in New South Wales. We're not seeing a gain because we haven't started any new contracts during the period, but we're not seeing a decline either.
Okay. All right. And John, I was wondering if you could, this is the first time we've had a chance to chat since Paul Garrity resigned. Could you give us, your take on what happened there? What the expectations are in terms of management stability over the course of the next 12 to 24 months?
Yeah, certainly. Look, there's nothing, nothing sinister in it. When you have management change, when you have a CEO change, and particularly when some of the previous management maybe were pretty aligned to my predecessor, one thing or another, then sometimes these things happen. There was no major fallout. There was no major difference of opinion. He wanted to go left and I wanted to go right, but maybe I'm just a little more impatient about some of the change in a few areas. I wanted to perhaps see some progress a little faster and slightly different nuances of opinions on things. And you put that together with the fact that Paul had been 13 or 14 years and been through some pretty tough times personally. I think everybody just felt it was probably time to amicably move on, which is what we plan to do. He's still on the payroll at the moment, still available, and early in the new year he will step down, and we are in the process of replacing him. But there's no, as I said, I'm quite comfortable. Each of the key divisions has its own CEO anyway, so it's not like we're missing a key day-to-day hands-on involvement at terminals has been run by Alistair Field in the way as it was when Paul was full-time. So it actually gives me a chance and the rest of the management team here to perhaps be a little more involved during this transition and understand and perhaps just stimulate some of the change that we think needs to take place. And then while we're doing that, we'll continue to look for a replacement. So nothing sinister. I think it's just normal progress. As for the rest of the management team, well, obviously, you know, never say never, but I'm quite comfortable. We now have a strong management team. Where we've appointed Julian Burrows to the key role of government affairs and corporate communication. She starts with us in 6 weeks' time. With that, I think we have a robust team going forward. Will there be more changes? I'm not planning it, but it could happen, of course. But if so, I think the business is quite resilient enough now to be able to manage that sort of change.
And what are you looking for in terms of the skill base for the replacement?
Well, without sort of going through the whole job spec, right, obviously.
No, but what are the two or three key things?
We're not necessarily looking for somebody who is completely staunched in the background of ports, but we're looking for somebody who understands that industry. We're looking for someone who is highly performance oriented and returns oriented, and we're looking for someone who, in particular, is customer focused. Where I think perhaps if we're guilty of anything, it's in the past, we haven't been, the whole industry hasn't been as customer focused as perhaps it should be, or I've certainly been used to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. That's all I had.
Operator, we might just take one last question if there's anyone in the queue, and otherwise we need to wrap up there.
There are no further questions in queue at this time.
Perfect timing. Well, thank you very much to everybody. Really appreciate the participation, and I wish you all a very good afternoon.
And this does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.